Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the What's Up podcast, recorded on the 6th of July 2016. Tonight we're going to be talking a little bit about Juno Space Mission, a new ISS module that went up in April, and also the FAST telescope. On tonight's panel is myself, Martin Black, who's an engineer who builds next generation space telescopes.
I'm Alistair Bruce. I'm in my final year of the PhD and I study active galaxies.
And I'm William Taylor. I'm an instrument scientist, so I spend my time working with engineers and scientists to build stuff.
So I guess the first thing I want to talk about is Juno.
Yeah, this is cool.
You might guess we're all pretty excited about this.
That's kind of the top story at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess we can be in a good mood because everything worked. So it's only...
So far, are we allowed to clap?
Like all the engineers going whoop whoop in the videos and everything. So this was like the Hail Mary pass, the fun bit of any space mission to another planet. You're going crazy fast. And I think in this case, this was a record-breaking fast mission. Mm-hmm. Was it something ridiculous like 75 kilometers per second it was doing? Relative to Jupiter.
250,000 miles an hour. So I don't know, can't do the math in my head, but yeah, it was fast.
Yeah, it's quite scary. So there's two types of mission. You've got your flyby mission, and that's easy to do because you don't have to brake. And then you've got your orbiting missions, which is what Juno is, one of those. And to orbit something, you then have to slow down once you get there, or you're going to fling way off back into outer space. So this was like the parking maneuver, which is really scary because Jupiter was what? 45 minutes away at the speed of light in communication terms with Earth. And the probe was going to have to fire its engine for 35 minutes to slow it down enough that Jupiter actually would sort of catch it and hold onto it in an orbit. And everything had to work on autopilot. So this is a little bit like when Curiosity was landing on Mars. All done by autopilot. You wait for a tiny little ping in the telemetry to let you know that it's done everything that it was supposed to. And, you know, it's the sort of squeaky bottom time for all the mission planners and designers, and there's almost no science done yet because you haven't been close enough and you haven't had time to point at it yet either. Yeah. So yeah, it's quite scary, but it seems to have been, apparently the orbit was so perfect that they've ended up in, they were within 1 second of their planning, and given how many, you know, is it millions of kilometres that they're travelling? And it's quite scary. I think it's 5 astronomical units to Jupiter. Anyone?
Yeah, depends where we are, I think.
Yeah, so that's the...
It's five from the sun.
Yes, so 5 Earth-sun distances is Jupiter's sort of average. And it's visible at night, so it can't be too far away from us at the moment. But yeah, I haven't sat down and worked it out.
I have to think about it, yeah. Yeah, it's between 4 and 6.
So why is Juno cool from an engineering point of view?
Well, there's lots of things in there, but I mean, partially the most noticeable thing is the fact it's got whopping great big bus-sized solar panels, which is quite awesome. And that's the deepest, most distant spacecraft powered by solar panels, I think.
I think so. I think Rosetta has solar panels, but it doesn't get quite as far away.
I think it did for a little bit, but it turned itself off.
Yes,
it was kind of sleeping, and when it was at most its point, because you wouldn't expect it to work that far. So it's That's pretty cool. Step one.
Just from a really nice suite of instruments on it as well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things for sort of peering through the clouds, looking at the details of how the planet formed, how the planet works. There's a lot of magnetometers, gravity sensors, analyzing the EM fields, looking at the aurora. Huge amount of detail, just lots of cool instruments.
I love the fact that one of the things they're trying to do is look to see where it's got a solid core or what the core is made of, because we don't know, which I think is pretty awesome. Like, is it a big ball of gas? In principle, is it a big ball of gas where you could just sort of fall all the way in? It's obviously not true, because under lots of pressure in the middle, the gas turns to a liquid. But is there a solid, chunky, rocky thing at the bottom middle, which has kind of formed first and then gathered an atmosphere? Or we don't know. And that's kind of, I think that's pretty damn cool, actually.
It's sort of going to answer a lot of questions about solar system formation and planet formation, both in our solar system and in exo.
Exactly. Well, one of the weird things about the exoplanets we're finding is that we keep finding whopping great big things, you know, Jupiter-sized objects, close to their stars, like as close in as Mercury, if not closer. And so some people think that maybe the planets form close in like that, and then they kind of drift outwards over time. So they might be able to work that out, I think. Something was saying that the sort of the way, by looking at the composition of Jupiter in more detail, you might work out whether it formed nearer to the sun and moved around or not, which is again pretty cool.
I think that's the key, isn't it? If there's a bit of rocky stuff in the middle, then you could say it was just like the Earth, except it wandered out a little bit and then grabbed onto...
And it was the bigger, rockier thing at the time, so it just got an atmosphere which is thousands of miles thick.
But we should maybe talk about the fact that it's a gas giant, because we've sort of skimmed nicely over that as well. But it's, you know, this is a chunky monkey. So I think if you added up all the mass of all the other planets and all the other stuff that's floating in the solar system, you still don't get to Jupiter mass. So relative to the sun, it's still not a huge amount of mass at all, but Jupiter's a very chunky planet. One of the gas giants, so it's mostly hydrogen and helium with a smattering of other stuff, and it's very hard to see past that cloudy surface that it has, so we're not actually sure partly what drives some of the formation of the bands of clouds on Jupiter. You've got the equatorial belts that look like tiger stripes in the telescope
which
images.
Partially because of the rotation speed. It spins so quickly in like...
It's something like 11 Earths across, and it spins on its own axis every 9 hours or something. It's just crazy.
Do we know why it's been so fast, or is that
new?
I guess we'll find out if Juno's got the equipment to peer through the
clouds. Yeah, I wonder if we can work that out. I mean, it's got huge magnetic fields in comparison to Earth's vast things. I don't know if that could... Any coupling of that?
I went to a fun talk the other day where they were talking about, this is something we'll talk about in a couple of years' time, so it's a mission called JUICE, the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. So this is ESA's we're going to one-up you NASA kind of mission. So this one's... It's going to be interesting. That mission will be really fun if it works, because it's actually going to go one better than Juno in that it's going to orbit one of the moons, which I think is fantastic. It's also the biggest moon in the solar system, so that's Ganymede. And it might have liquid water under the surface as well, so this one's very interesting. It's also slightly further away from Jupiter than the really scary bits of radiation that we'll have to talk about in a minute for Juno. But they're going to try and do this, but not till 2030. But she was talking about the magnetic field and said if you could actually see it on the sky, it would take up most of the sky. It can actually stretch out as far as Saturn. So when Voyager flew past Saturn, they think Saturn was actually in the wake of Jupiter's magnetic tail, if you like, because it gets buffeted by the solar wind. So it's huge on the...
It's kind of focused.
It's crazy big, and it's kind of interesting that it's so huge, but we can't see it at all.
Which again is partially because there's this charged liquid, I think, that the material in the... below the atmosphere, below the gaseous, cloudy atmosphere is liquidized because of the pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think you've got large currents flowing within that potentially.
It's like a mega dynamo or something. So it's similar to how the Earth gets its own magnetic field. It's just a bigger version.
On a colossal scale.
So, and about the radiation.
Yeah.
So you've got they get called the Van Allen belts around the Earth because he was the first person to...
Mr. Van Allen.
They're nasty. They're kind of slightly different, but it's basically the Earth's magnetic field acts a little bit like a bottle for charged particles, so it can actually hold on to things from the solar wind. So the plasma comes in, and depending on what type of particle you are, and this also applies to some cosmic rays as well, you get fast-moving particles. So they're highly energetic and really, really nasty to electronics. So not good for humans either, but luckily most astronauts don't spend too long in the belts, so it was fine for the Apollo missions and things. And Jupiter's...
Well, that's what everybody says, but that's another issue.
Well, Jupiter's radiation, you have to sort of take those and then turn it up to 11, so the way more energetic particles there, it'll fry just about anything that flies into those regions. And the orbit planners for the Juno mission were really crafty. So they're coming in over the poles where there's much less of this issue. And they skim down as close to Jupiter's surface as they dare to get below the worst of the radiation. So that's kind of where the ISS is just now. It's a little bit below where the nasty bit is. And then they'll skim back out and do that a few times. But it still gets slightly toasted on the way in and the way out. So
I think it's worth mentioning. So one of the instruments on board Juno is called JunoCam. And it's essentially the imager that's designed to take pretty pictures. I think Ali was saying it's the first ever instrument on a satellite to be solely there for outreach purposes.
Definitely pictures. Away from the Earth. It's possible there's other things pointing at the Earth right now, but this is, extra planetary type stuff.
The slight downside is this is only going to last through 7 orbits because of the radiation damage. That's just going to get fried after 7 orbits.
I think the orbits are quite big, aren't they? That initially sounds really bad. Oh, only 7 orbits. But actually, I think the orbits are tens of days. So it's the mission only has tens of orbits.
I thought it was a longer mission. It's only like a fraction of it. I mean, it's still not going to be like a day.
It's parked in something like a 50-day orbit at the moment. And that's going to get more circularized. I can't even say that. I think it stays slightly elliptical because they want to be able to image the planet from afar, and then they'll swoop back in through the nasty bits.
Yeah, you have to, because otherwise you'd be...
But I think the final orbit's closer to 14 days, so they're going to shrink it down a little bit. So yeah, I don't think it will be fully circular. But it's only got, what, 2 years lifespan?
Yeah.
And that's mainly because of the radiation. So
and then they crash it into the upper atmosphere.
Which is very nice of them. Cool. This is like cosmic... tidying, because they're actually a little bit worried about contaminating Europa, which is one of Jupiter's moons, might have life on it, potentially very interesting. And the JUICE mission might have spent more time around Europa, but it's a bit too close to the nasty radiation, so I think Ganymede wins because of that. But I do like the fact that they had to put the titanium vault on this spacecraft, so there's just an inch thick cube of titanium and all the important electronics are inside it. And that's not enough to protect it from the radiation, but it takes a big bite out of it, so it won't be as bad. But it's only a matter of time before something goes wrong, so I'm just hoping it survives for the pretty pictures, I guess.
So when do we get any pictures? Have they given indication?
They said a couple of weeks in one of the press releases.
Because as you're saying, it's in a larger orbit now. It's got another manoeuvre to get into its final orbit.
Well, I think
finally.
So, yeah.
When is that? Do we know?
I think they're aware that they get only a couple of chances to do this current science that they want to do, where they're getting really close to Jupiter itself. I think they're maybe focusing on getting the data first and then worrying about sending it back
fair enough.
Later.
Probably priorities.
But it'll be fun because these should be some of the best pretty pictures that we've ever seen about Jupiter, which is kind of
nice. And of the poles, which we have pretty much no idea about, really, I think.
I think it's also quite cool to mention, you mentioned the sort of cosmic tidying side of things. Those of you that know about the Rosetta mission, they've set a date for tidying up Rosetta as well. Yeah, so I think it's the 8th of September this year.
Yeah, when they will try.
They're going to be parking Rosetta down on the comet.
It's meant to be a soft touchdown. Isn't it?
Yeah, I think the term soft here is a bit loose.
Yeah. I think the original idea wasn't that they would try and land it somewhere near to Philly, but since they don't actually know where
they're romantic in me wants
they
that to
thought
happen.
It is, where they think it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Is there any reason for doing that other than the fact that it sounds sort of appeal to the romantic side of Ali? I'm not saying that's why Rosetta have chosen to do it.
I think it's a learning thing. If you have the chance to learn how to do a touchdown on...
I meant is there any reason to try and land it near Philly?
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, I still don't think they know exactly where it is.
No.
So, they might be sort of saying, you know, this is a mystery we would like to solve before we never get a chance to see anything again.
They are going to have the cameras running the entire time as it plunges towards
tremendous
the comet. So they might actually get a photograph of Philly rushing up to meet Rosetta.
Yeah, I don't even need a photo, just a little glint off of one of the panels or something. That would be nice. You can sort of a little wave to it from wherever you park. That would be
on a similar vein, but a slight tangent, if I'm allowed, that of deaths of wonderful satellites. Cassini is, I think it's next year. Cassini will do a similar thing.
Isn't it September this year? Or am I talking rubbish?
Well, it's plunging into the upper atmosphere of Saturn in the same way because it's come to the end of its mission. But the thing I love is the fact that they're doing a final attempt to fly between the planet and the rings before they crash it, because they wanted to do that earlier because it's probably really interesting science, but the chances are you're going to go smacking into a small chunk of ice in the inner ring section. It doesn't look like there's a ring, it looks like a gap, but it probably isn't a gap, so that's going to be pretty awesome because they're going to fly through Saturn's rings. I mean this is Star Trek Voyager credits, isn't it? Pretty much.
Anyway, that's good, it's good that they're tidying up after themselves as well. That mission's lasted an incredible amount of time too. How many years is it now? Is it like 10, 15 or something?
It's got a plutonium drivey thing, hasn't it, I think.
Which we're now running short of.
There's also question marks about launching them.
Some people got annoyed at Curiosity stealing some plutonium to drive itself around because Mars is close enough for solar panels. So given that it's a finite supply on the Earth, there's more distanced.
Solar panels, that was Spirit Opportunity, which everyone broke down. That was part of the problem, is it got stuck and then sandstorms covered it.
Beached.
Stuck on a rock.
Couldn't NASA send it all to Mars? And then people were like, oh no, we've run out of plutonium, we'll have to go and get it. So they'll have to build a really good mission to go and collect it. It'll be really good. So they just pack
this
it off.
This is verging into the world of politics. Yeah. Let's move beyond that.
Plutonium's a cool thing though. So if anyone's seen The Martian, it's kind of there. One of the issues, but it's one of him sciencing the out of stuff. But plutonium just decays naturally and generates heat, and you can plug a device into it that just produces electricity from that heat, and it means it doesn't matter how far from the sun you are, you can still power your instruments. So this is why Voyager's still trucking. So even though it's the furthest human-made object from us, it's still got enough juice to run about half of its instruments, I think, but the power's slowly dropping off. It's good for another 10 years or something.
You can also use it to make bombs. That's not for sure.
So shorter-term missions, a bit closer to home. In April, a new module went up to the ISS. Now, this was an interesting one because it wasn't the usual solid lump of aluminium tubing that they send up. This was an inflatable bag. Very fancy inflatable bag, but, you know.
That you would live in, right?
Yeah.
This is a habitation.
Well, so this is called BEAM. It's the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module.
Sounds a bit wrong.
Yeah, I did raise questions about... Well, it's made by Bigelow Aerospace. Bigelow Aerospace, I should say.
If I'm right, they actually bought the patents from NASA, because apparently NASA did some tests in the 60s about inflatable stuff for putting astronauts in, and then sort of gave up because it was a bit expensive. And I'm not actually sure why they gave up, other than cost, maybe. Too busy getting to the moon, perhaps.
Yeah.
But they've now got those original things and just sort of built on that. So that's really interesting.
I remember hearing a talk about this because Mr. Bigelow is the chap who owns the company and he's a bit like an Elon Musk. He's made loads of money. But the thing which particularly struck me was the talk was the person was saying Mr. Bigelow is quite a strange character. And he said, to highlight this fact, he was born in Las Vegas. It's like, he didn't just visit for a weekend. He was born and grew up in Las Vegas. It's like, that says enough about the man.
Isn't Las Vegas quite a big city?
I suppose it is. People must be, I know, but the sentiment, come on. You know, who raises kids in Las Vegas?
Thousands of people, probably.
Yeah, all right, okay. But moving on.
So are you saying visited an inflatable casino? And this is where he got there. That's what I'm going to do. I mean, in theory, it sounds like a really nice idea, right? Because the idea is that you save mass, and mass is everything if you want to send humans somewhere.
And volume. So I mean, so the I have the numbers here, in fact. Ooh. The module, when packed up, was 2.16 meters in length and 2.36 meters in diameter, and essentially sat behind the Dragon capsule that delivered supplies to the ISS. Then on delivery, the Canada arm on board the ISS, the robotic arm, was driven into place, pulled the thing out the back of the Dragon X capsule, brought it over to the airlock, put it on itself. So there was somebody driving it, but it was all installed by the robotic arm, no spacewalking involved. Screwed onto the airlock, and then inflated. And its inflated size is about 4 meters in length and 3 meters in diameter. You're almost sort of doubling the volume from what you packed to your final volume. That's pretty good.
Do you think the person on the station who had his finger on the inflate button was a little bit nervous? I mean, just in terms of, you know, if it hadn't worked, clearly this is something they would have worked the kinks out by now, because they've launched a few prototypes before this
they
one.
Have, yeah. No, which haven't got attached to the space station. Yeah,
but, you know, anything under pressure, anything that has the risk of a violent event.
I think inflatable is a loose use of the word. It's not. I don't think this is like a, you know, it's not like a balloon where you attach it and it goes.
No.
It's more that this folds out in a clever kind of way.
Yeah. So there is still a metal frame
There's a framework to it.
Because it has to be able to handle micrometeorite. I don't think it's pressurized.
It is pressurized, yeah.
Well, it's supported by pressure.
Supported by pressure.
Yeah, there was a good selfie that with all the ISS astronauts in the module facing out the way. That looked kind of cool.
Yeah, they weren't there for very long.
I'd have been a bit nervous too.
So they're not using the module for anything. It's purely instrumentation inside. So once they got it pressurized and it didn't actually fully extend properly, it's about 2 centimeters short of what its full extension should be. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I guess it's not enough to worry about.
Too well wrapped up. So
what they've done now is they've got all the instruments are inside, measuring radiation, micrometeorite impacts, thermal loading, all that kind of stuff. They then close the airlock and that's it. Right. They go in once a year or twice a year to check the data.
To see how it's
doing. But they're not using it. It's completely sealed off. And in 2 years' time, it gets detached from the ISS and burns up in the atmosphere.
All right. So is that partially because there's an experimental edge to it?
Yeah.
That, let's say it survives for 2 years and it's shown that it can stand micro.
Yeah.
Yeah, can't say that, but you know.
So it's designed to withstand micrometeorite impact. And if it does get a penetration, it shouldn't get penetration, but if it does, it's not going to pop and, you know, go squirting across. It's going to slowly leak. At that point, they'll get a warning and they can fix it, which I guess is like a patch repair kit you get for a tent, only sort of sticky on plaster.
Yeah.
A really fancy one.
Nice.
Yeah. That's a really, really cool idea.
Yeah.
Lots of potential.
You can, you feel like that's got
Yeah, I like it. I can sort of see it more as a kind of thing if you wanted to set up a base really cheaply and quickly. Mm-hmm. Just bring a bunch of them with you, stick them under the top layer of soil and, you know, carve out a wee space for yourself. Yeah. And then you've got the soil to protect you from anything. That
I think also for long duration sort of deep space missions, like if you go back to the moon, going to Mars, where you want a smaller rocket for getting out of the atmosphere and back into the atmosphere, but you want a bit more living space in between. Mm-hmm. You could have pods like this that inflate and each person gets their own 4 meter cubed space themselves. Mm. And then when you actually start to go into atmosphere, pull all this back in again and you can get back or jettison it if you're not using it back.
Again, yeah.
There's a lot of potential. Mm. So yeah, we'll see what happens with that. 2 years time. Maybe an idea that, you know, inflatable space hotels have been talked about for years.
Space hotels? I'm not going to lie, if they got it working, I would probably be quite happy to spend my lottery winnings on that.
Or your dad's lottery winnings. if we move swiftly on, or quickly on, towards a fast telescope.
Oh, so you did.
I've been working on my transitions.
Nice.
That's very good, yeah. Appalling transition. But
what's the acronym?
It's the 500 meter aperture spherical telescope.
And it's lying twice, FMA. Is that not right?
It's lying twice.
I knew you'd both be annoyed at this.
It is not spherical. And it is not a 500 meter aperture. But what it is, and we'll come to why it's neither of those things in a moment, is the world's largest radio telescope, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Currently,
and depending on the other's definitions. And anyway, it's a very large dish. If you've seen the end of GoldenEye, there's the great bit when Sean Bean unsurprisingly dies. That's not a spoiler because Sean Bean's in the film. At the Arecibo telescope, which is... Well, previously the record holder, which was a 300-meter dish. This thing's 500 meters. So it's used for collecting radio waves from all manner of astronomical objects, interesting things like pulsars, etc. Or AGN, possibly even your kind of alley science. But we're not going to talk to you about that now. It's made out of 4,500 sort of triangles of mesh, effectively, which are suspended in a, not a crater.
Dip in the ground.
Yeah.
A kind of spherical bowl in the
ground. Suitably shaped
hollow. It had a word, is it a karst? Is it?
Yeah,
a karsk.
I don't know what that means.
It's something to do with the limestone underneath has dissolved away.
And you get a kind of nice bowl-shaped thing. Basically filled this bowl, which when you think about it, is half a kilometer across. I mean, it's this huge area. They filled this with these panels to make a radio telescope, which is very exciting, and it's exciting in many levels because obviously, I mean, it sets the record. It's going to be more sensitive than anything that currently exists. I think it's also exciting politically because this was China making quite a big statement of like this is one of their... China have been involved in a lot of astronomical projects, but possibly often maybe on slightly smaller scales, or they've been partners of other things, whereas this is a fully Chinese project and they've gone right in at the deep end and gone, right, we can build the biggest. So that's great. I suppose to highlight the things we're saying before, this is not like a normal telescope. If you think of a normal telescope, one you might have at home, it's often on a mount and you can move it around and point it at objects in the sky. The difficulty is with a 500 meter dish, you can't point the thing around. You can't move it very easily because it's filling literally a mountainside. And so you have to, instead, you move the focus. Mm. So the you can imagine a kind of bowl-shaped thing, which is any telescope is kind of a big bowl, and it brings the light back to a focus, and you have a focus kind of sitting up above the center of the bowl, if you imagine. Well, by moving the direction of the focus, so the thing where everything is coming, the bit in the center above the middle of the bowl, you can kind of direct where that is. I'm waving my hands around. It makes a lot of sense when you can see my hands.
So basically, straight up is easy, but when you start going off to the side, you have to work a wee bit harder and you'll start to lose data if you go too far off.
So you have a limited field. You can't look at the whole sky. As you say, you can look up very easily, but then you can kind of adjust the focus point and look at different parts of your dish. But the thing about this is, it means when you're looking at different parts of your dish, you don't actually look at the full thing. So you don't actually ever use the full 500 meter aperture. You only use sort of a 300 meter part of the large. Yeah.
So that's lie number one. And lie number two is that it's not actually spherical, either. It's parabolic.
Yeah.
It's so a small distinction.
The mirror shape isn't actually a big bowl. It's actually kind of a well, the shape of the bowl isn't a perfect sphere, it's something else.
But the bit I found quite interesting that Arecibo can't do is that they can actually adjust the shape of that curvature, which is pretty clever. Pretty cool. I like. So yeah,
it's this is a very cool telescope. It's very exciting. I mean, we're being mean about its name, but it's probably got a different name in Chinese, which maybe makes more sense.
About access to it, are China taking half of the time and letting the other half go to, or who funded it?
I'm not actually sure anything about it being shared,
because I can see it being quite busy, and given that it's kind of the hottest thing in radio astronomy until SCA is ready. Yeah, I guess
find some Chinese collaborators. I mean, SCA, the square kilometer array was an idea to build a telescope which would have a collecting area, which was 1 square kilometer. So actually, this would be lots of little telescopes where you add together the light from the different telescopes. Again, a radio telescope, but you'd add together the little telescopes to give you an area which is equivalent of 1 square kilometer. But actually, I don't think SKA is looking towards that size in reality. I think the total collecting area will probably be more like this sort of size of FAST for SKA in the end.
But I guess because they spread the dishes out,
they spread the dishes, you can get a more detailed image.
Synthesized dish.
It's a bit more complicated.
Is it only a matter of time before we get another movie set in the bowl of this particular telescope?
Yeah, I think Bond have a good tradition of using astronomical sites in their films. So there was Arecibo in GoldenEye, in Quantum of Solace, the hotel where all the baddies are towards the end of the film.
Is that the hotel that explodes really easily?
Yes, it's a very badly designed hotel from a fire safety point of view.
That is in fact the Residencia next to the VLT. Very large telescopes in Chile.
Yeah, not in Bolivia, as they say in the film.
It's in Chile. I think there's quite a few people who were glad to see that place blow up in the film after spending prolonged periods there. And in the newest Bond film, whose name I forget,
Spectre.
I remember watching the film and getting very upset when in the background I went, that's a telescope dome. Why is there a VLT support telescope dome in the background? Then they go outside and there's a whole bunch of telescope domes in a location where you wouldn't put telescopes without telescopes in them, and it makes absolutely no sense.
I don't remember this bit at all. I'm going to have to go watch it again.
Go watch.
So the challenge for the next Bond, whoever that may be. Actually, Daniel Gipness is a different point. this is a different podcast. Welcome to. is to try and get the faster telescope in, because it is good. I mean, it must look pretty impressive. Half a kilometre of collecting area. I mean, that's just staggering.
I'm just wondering, setting a Bond film in China, given current politics,
might actually be very good. I'm sure.
Maybe better done at the Square Kilometre Array.
Yeah.
South Africa and Australia. Maybe that's a better plan.
So in GoldenEye, wasn't the fun that the whole thing was buried underwater as well?
Yeah,
which
it was flooded.
Which Arecibo can't do that, but that was quite a nice little touch, I thought.
It did look cool. Mm-hmm. It's a shame that the Arecibo would look a lot cooler if they could.
We're diverging.
We are diverging.
Well, no, we've diverged.
I think we have. And this is probably a good point to call it to quits as well.
It's just long overdue.
Yeah. Go watch my James Bond book set now.
Thank you very much all for listening.
Take care.
Cheers. Bye.